Good evening. Welcome to the Salary Report. Today's Thursday, January 20th, 2011. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me tonight. Tonight, Money in Markets, and Ask Catherine, then a lively interview with the leading independent pollster, Scott Rasmussen. He's the founder of Rasmussen Reports, and we recorded him earlier, so I've already heard it, and it's a good one. Finally, a review of Josh Fox's 2010 documentary, Gasland, about gas drilling in the United States since 2005 using a simulation method known as hydraulic fracturing, which is sometimes commonly referred to as fracking. Our theme for tonight is Peace Be With You. I got a call today from ACE reporter Kelly Patricia Mira. If you've never read her stories on psychotropic drugs such as Ritalin and the relationship between those drugs and the school shootings, I strongly recommend them to you. You can pick them up with a search on Google. She has a website. She's an outstanding investigative reporter, and she has a bumper sticker on her car, which I'll never forget. It says, "May there be peace in this world, and may it start with me." It took me many years to understand that peace was not the absence of war. Peace is a condition. It's a state of grace. It's a state of mind. And each one of us contribute to peace by simply being in that state. I talked last week about the video of Nick Begich. Did a wonderful interview with Alex Jones after the Arizona shootings and talked about how important it was to stay in a state of, in a higher mind, and how fear brings us into a lower mind where we can't make intelligent decisions. And I have been absolutely amazed how many times that conversation and that topic has come up this week in a whole variety of different settings. And it came up again today because of the reports of the shootings supposedly a gun going off accidentally in Los Angeles in a school. And I want to stress so much that on many of these things, we need to either wait for the evidence, or if we can't get hard evidence on what really happened, which is at this point very difficult to do. It's very important to say, I don't know. Don't try and find certainty or closure by jumping to conclusions, let alone concluding the spin that gets pushed in the media, particularly if it's a policy result. A happened and B happened, therefore we must do C. So I know I bring that up again, but do not let these events put you into a state of fear, because we really need to do whatever we can to stay out of that state. I was reminded today by a new blog post that I just put up. It's a lecture that Solzhenitsyn made. It's called Beauty Will Save the World, and it's quite remarkable. And it reminded me of the time during the worst part in the most stressful and dangerous part of the litigation in the 90s when the physical harassment got very dangerous and it was very easy to go into a state of fear. We made something up, which I've lost and I can't find, so don't ask me to publish it because I can't find it anywhere. But we sat and we spent a couple of hours together, the Salary team, making something which we called the beauty tool. And it was everything that wasn't very expensive that brought beauty into our lives. And what we decided is that we needed a very significant infusion of beauty every day into our lives. And so if you want to feel inspired, read the piece Beauty Will Save the World by Solzhenitsyn, or make a list of the things that bring beauty into your life. But beauty for me is one thing that can always pull me back out of fear. Figure out what does it for you, but don't let yourself go there. So that's my kind of little speech for the week. Money and markets, in some ways it was a slow news week because I kept looking around at everything that was going on and said, that's what I said in the year-end wrap-up. We're making a transcript thanks to one of the subscribers for the year-end wrap-up. I'll have it for you. If we don't publish it before, we'll have it by the next Salary Report. And if you didn't listen to the year-end wrap-up but prefer to read text, I strongly recommend it. It's a great framework for everything that's going on and will be going on this year. Geopolitics, we continue to see around the globe, in Europe, in the United States, everybody struggling with a combination of too much debt and debasement to deal with the debt. In many respects, the debasement is more painful than the debt or defaults on the debt. A summit between the President Obama and President Hu Jintao of China this week in Washington. What they're talking about is sort of how you rebalance the pie. And there's a lot of tension and cooperation back and forth in doing that. The conversation keeps going around a couple things. One is currency. The more the Chinese currency rises, the easier it is for us to export to China, the more our imports drop. And so that's part of the pie. Noise from the Chinese that the dollar needs to be replaced. Don't read too much into it. The dollar is much stronger than the sort of internet chatter is making out for it to be. Access to markets. The Chinese want to be able to export more into the United States, and the United States wants to be able to export more into China. Part of the challenge is if you look at the consumer market, say if the U.S. GNP is about $14 trillion, $10 trillion is consumer purchases. I mean, we are a consumer-centric society and economy, and that's about 50% of the United States, of the global consumer pie. So 50% is about, the United States at $10 trillion is about 50% of the $20 trillion globally, the BRIC nations only being about a third of that. So rebalancing the pie is going to continue. Now, part of that is, what does China do with its dollars? Because China, as the dollars go down in value, China would like to do nothing more than convert them into some kind of tangible, and that includes making investments back in the United States. And so one of the areas is how much can we invest there and in what, and how much can they invest here? And, of course, the issue always comes down to control. The Chinese have historically been very astute at about only letting foreigners buy non-voting shares, things like that. And so when it comes to major investments here, it's the same issue. Who's going to allow what kind of influence and controls on the means of production. QE2 continues. Every sign is that it continues to push up the cost of food and basic necessities, and expect that to continue. Housing, despite QE2, is still flat to down. As long as housing is down and not coming up, it makes it much easier for the central bankers to print. A very chilling statistic in the food area. The New York Times today reports that Walmart now has 33% of the grocery market in the United States. I emailed a very close ally of mine, one of the top food consultants in the world, said, is this true? He said, yes, and came back and said, the thing that's amazing about it is they've done it in 15 years from scratch. So they've gone from 0% of the grocery market to 33% in 15 years. Quite a chilling commentary on centralization and consolidation of the food supply. Today is January 20th. That's Inauguration Day. We don't have a new administration. We've got a new Congress. Obama gives his State of the Union next Tuesday. He's now experienced the House voting to repeal his health care bill. It's widely believed to have zero chance of passing the Senate, so it's a Pyrrhic expression, if anything. What's missing across the board, and you definitely see it when you look at the Chinese American relations, is the United States and China, like most other countries in the world now, are struggling to keep their economies going with government stimulus and government money. So it's a command control economy. Growing more that way, the more it grows command control, the tougher it makes on fundamental productivity. And we may be shifting power to corporations, but the corporations are ever more dependent on government to guarantee everything from credit to consumer purchases. Perhaps the most chilling sign of behind all of this was Vermont Senator Sanders gave an interview to Raw Story and talked about his inability to achieve assurances from the White House that they were not planning on fiddling with Social Security. It's linked on the blog, and it's a little chilling. Let me just give you some quotes. Quote, I have to tell you, I've been on the phone to the very, very highest levels of the Obama administration, and the responses that I'm getting are not assuring, Senator Bernie Sanders said in an exclusive interview, what I'm told is that no definitive decisions have been made on the issue of Social Security. I expect that is probably true. So let's see what, if anything, Obama says in the State of the Union next Tuesday night. In the precious metals market, as I said, as I talked with Franklin Sanders last week, big question in my mind is we're due for a correction both in terms of where we are in the run of precious metals and where we are in the timing of the year. So if history says anything, we should get a correction. Franklin and I talked about a correction of as much as 10 to 20% in gold and even more. He said 35% silver. I think that's a little bit deep, but silver is more volatile. And so the big question, which I kept discussing all week long, is correction or no. Precious metals is off today, but I think it's still too early. There is no doubt that there is tremendous interest globally from very big markets in shifting money into this very thin market. And so, this time it could be different, but again, I continue to believe that we get a big correction. If we do, it's only part of the long-term bull market. And so, I continue to be a holder, not a seller. A little bit of a he said, she said with Max Keiser. I gave an interview to the Financial Survival podcast and said that I thought that wonderful Max Keiser's campaign to crash J.P. Morgan Chase was a little bit naive. I didn't think that, since I think J.P. Morgan Chase is operating on behalf of the U.S. Government Exchange Stabilization Fund, that you're trying to crash the U.S. government. And I think that, before you try and crash the U.S. government, you ought to be aware of what you're up against. So Max published a little thing on his blog saying why I was wrong, being very charming about it. I don't think I'm wrong. What I do agree with is I do agree that it's a great campaign. I think the more we can decentralize the control of precious metals, I think the more we can decentralize financial power, and that's great. So I love the campaign. I just think I'd rather draw power away from the New World Order than say I can crash J.P. Morgan Chase when, in fact, what I'm trying to do is crash the U.S. government. So I realize Max is a little bit more entertaining and mine's a little bit more complicated, but the bottom line is I agree with the campaign, but I don't think we're going to crash J.P. Morgan Chase unless the people who are consolidating the silver out of J.P. Morgan Chase want to crash. My hero this week, interestingly enough, I'm speaking to you from Malvern, Pennsylvania, where I've been based for the last 2 months, and I've had my office, I've had an office at the National Bank of Malvern, which is a wonderful community bank where I and my companies bank, and we did, almost 2 years ago, we did a wonderful interview with the leadership of National Bank of Malvern when we did our Solari report on how to find a good community bank. I said to my attorney today, how many people are there who can say they adore and admire their bankers? My bankers are my cousins. We share a great-grandfather who was a Secretary of Agriculture in Pennsylvania, believe it or not, and his claim to fame was he organized the small farmers so that they could compete against the big guys. It seems to be a family tradition. But having worked here with them and their wonderful team, it's just great business people, honest business people, very community-oriented people who make a huge difference just by getting up every day and working hard and trying to do their best. It's just a reminder of how many great community bankers there are in this country, and I encourage you to find them, to get to know them, to build relationships with them. They're the blood of their community, and I have to tell you, it's wonderful to be a small business person who has bankers that they really admire and trust. So you can find them too, and that Solari report is in the archives, and I recommend it to you if you're looking. There's a link up on our website on just sort of the process of how to find a great local bank, and don't feel badly about if you bank at a big bank, but if it's going to give you energy to switch, then start the process and go through the process and see if you can't find somebody you really enjoy banking with. Okay, ask Catherine a lot of good questions. Would a slush fund founded at Vatican Bank connected to the U.S. Treasury be illegal? If so, how can we confirm? A slush fund at the Vatican Bank for the U.S. Treasury is likely to have some umbrella from national security law to all sorts of governmental laws that will make it legal, although these things are all often open to the creative interpretation of different government agencies. So, you know, the Italian government might find a way to say it's illegal, and there could be a debate. But in my experience, if you go to a high enough level, there's always a way to make something legal under national security law, it would seem. If so, how can we confirm? I don't know that you could. It would take an awful lot of money and time, and that might not either, you know, work anyway. Another question about free energy devices. Sterling Allen's information is some of the most positive and exciting information I heard lately. He gives a fantastic interview and discusses possible financial economic impacts. I agree. Every time the scientists that I trust brief me on what's going on in energy technology, what's possible with new both energy and transportation technology, it's fantastic and very exciting. I have not yet had anybody on the Solari Report to go through some of these developments. It's pretty tricky to figure out who you can trust. And, of course, this is I'm a financial person, not an engineer. Needless to say, if some of this technology ever makes it into the day-to-day flow of the economy, it can have a quite dramatic impact in terms of lowering expenses and making all sorts of things impossible. So it's on my list to try and find legitimate sources who I can look to brief us on that. But I thank you for the suggestion. New war and demographic changes impact on precious metals. The status quo says metal prices are going higher. It's almost a no-brainer, but there are other variables I have trouble understanding. An aging population, assuming U.S. does not loosen immigration, suggests deflation. Gold did okay during the last depression, but silver did not, etc. Yes, there are many deflationary forces. I would encourage you to read Robert Landis's wonderful article about gold and deflation. If you do a search at the blog for gold and deflation, you'll pull it up. It's also published at the Golden Sextant, which is his website that he does with Reg Howe. At the same time, you know, I think we are in for a major correction, and I think it is very important to not bet the ranch on any one kind of asset or any one kind of investment. I put up a quote today on the blog from one of the most astute investors in the world that I know of, Tony Deaton, and it's really quite appropriate, and it says something to the effect of, I continue to believe that the safety of our capital depends on entrepreneurship and not on gold, silver, and government bonds. And I agree with Tony. So gold is not the magic bullet, but I do think we're in a long-term bull market, and despite all the deflationary trends, and I would encourage you to read Bob's wonderful article. On January 13, 2011, you and Franklin made your predictions and wager on year-end price of gold, but you failed to mention your silver predictions. I will endeavor to get Franklin to do that with me in the next Precious Metals Report in February. But good point. Peer-to-peer lending prosper, change, not for better. No other Solari-specific P2P sites. What about Kiva? I'm a member of Kiva. I blog occasionally about Kiva. It's a site where you can make microloans without earning interest in the emerging markets. It's a wonderful, wonderful way for young people to learn about the credit process and about investment. You can take $25, pay with a PayPal or credit card. But I think you can use PayPal, and then, you know, just revolve your credit on Kiva, making loans to people. They pay back. You make other loans, and so it's a great sort of way to get started, and particularly I think to teach young people. I sometimes buy people presents by getting them a credit on Kiva, and it's something that. You know, there's a really heartfelt connection to the people that you're financing, and you can see the other people who are joining in your syndicate to finance that entrepreneur, group of entrepreneurs. There is one new peer-to-peer lending site that I don't know much about on the web, and Generally, there's been an effort to not let these things really blossom, but I continue to hope that they will, because I think there's a lot of opportunity there. And I don't remember the offhand, the peer-to-peer, but I'll try and find it and post it. Finally, another question about gold and silver, which I'll postpone to the precious metals report the second week of February. Okay, well, it's my pleasure to introduce Scott Rasmussen, who is, in my opinion, the leading independent source on public opinion in America. He's the founder and president of Rasmussen Reports, which is the go-to website for polls and other information on what Americans are thinking and feeling and how that translates into policy in Washington and in the campaigns. I use Rasmussen Reports. I'm a subscriber and link regularly to it on the blog. I'm sure you've seen and heard me refer to it before. The reason is not just because Scott and his company are the leading independent pollsters. It's also because, in my opinion, they consistently are the most astute about defining and asking the important questions. They're based in Asbury Park, New Jersey, not on the 20th floor of a skyscraper in New York or D.C. And Scott is active in his community in New Jersey, which is reflected in his exceptional book he wrote and published in 2009, In Search of Self-Governance. He also is the author of a new book, Mad as Hell, on the Tea Party movement. Scott does not just publish about the issues which impact family and community wealth. He lives them every day. He's had quite a successful career as an entrepreneur. So, Scott, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the Solari Report.
Well, it's great to be with you, and I look forward to chatting with you today.
Well, how is it that you ended up with the most successful website on what I call taking America's pulse? What's the history? How did this happen?
Well, like all business things, there's a little bit of mistake involved and learning from mistakes. And for me, I grew up in the broadcasting business and spent much of my life trying to get away from it. And I ended up in trying to help some friends who were trying to put term limits on members of Congress back a while ago. And as I was doing that, they were struggling to get good polling help. I was a numbers guy. I had studied some polling earlier in my life, and I began to help them out. And at one point, I decided to put up a shingle and start a business, and that was right as the Internet was taking off. And it was an amazing thing. I didn't really know what the Internet was, but we put up a website early and quickly began to learn about what this new world was going to be. And it's like anything else, you have to learn from your customers. And we were shocked in the earliest days of the business with people coming in and really focusing on the polling data. And I think the insight that helped the most was that people wanted to come to the source themselves. They wanted to see the polling data. They wanted to see the questions that were asked. They wanted a variety of information. They didn't simply want to wait for a news editor to summarize it for them.
So you're, 'cause your site is very speedy. It's you know, there's a lot of new content regularly.
Right.
Now, I know one of the things you're known for, and I don't know a lot about polling, but one of the things you're known for is automated polls.
Right.
Maybe you can explain what it is you do that's a little bit different.
Well, you know, if you think about the process of designing a public opinion poll, there's probably a couple dozen steps involved, from thinking of the topic and working on the questions to who do you need to sample and all sorts of other things. Where do you get the phone numbers? Our polling and just about every other firm in America that does polls does almost all of the steps in the same way. We do a couple things that are different. One, in some cases, firms will hire out boiler rooms of people who will sit there and actually make phone calls. We have a very pleasant Midwestern voice that is recorded, and every person that takes our survey hears the exact same voice, asking the exact same question with the exact same nuance. And that's a big factor because of when we do tracking polls, you know, if we measure the president's job approval rating, tonight a survey is going out asking people about the president's job approval, those people are hearing the exact same phrasing that they heard on January 20th, 2009, the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated. So there's a real consistency to that. And the second thing that we do a little bit differently, there's every polling firm has slight differences on how they process the data. And the issues there are that if you just call people at random, you get some built-in biases. Women answer the phone more than men, older people more than younger people, and a whole series of other differences. So you have to begin to make sure your final sample reflects the population at large. And one of the things that we're able to do is we also make sure there's an appropriate balance between Republicans and Democrats and unaffiliated voters. Not all firms take that step.
Now, you focus on likely voters.
That's correct.
Is that a difference as well?
Yes, that's, and I want to be clear on this. We focus on likely voters for our political topics. So we also poll on consumer and investor confidence every single night. We do a number of topics where we measure simply all adults, because if you're talking about consumer spending issues, adults are the appropriate sample to be measuring. But when we get into political topics, we always do likely voters. The differences are that you have a slightly older sample because young people don't vote as much. You have a slightly whiter sample because white people tend to participate a little more heavily in elections than minorities. And as a result of those changes in the current environment, you end up with results that are a little bit more in the Republican direction. The difference is probably about 3 or 4 percentage points. So if Gallup were to have a survey of all adults that said the president's job approval is 50%, we would be showing it probably at 46 or 47% among likely voters.
Now, one of the things I most wanted to talk to you about today was the deeper issues. What are the deeper issues that Americans are concerned with and thinking about? And you so wonderfully published a new survey of just those things.
Well, you know, the issues that concern Americans as we start into 2011 in a political context start off with the economy. It is the biggest topic. It has been for a couple of years. And, you know, we take it for granted now that's the big issue. But when George Bush was reelected just over six years ago in 2004, it was national security matters that were number one. The economy has been in this role for several years now, and every other issue just about that's near the top, whether it's health care or taxes, you know, people are looking at those issues largely in terms of how they relate to the overall economy.
Now, 87% said the economy is very important.
Right.
And I know when you published, you said that that's 5 points up from late October. Is that the highest you've ever seen the economy?
It's the highest it's been in several years, and it's just about as high as we've ever seen it. I mean, you never get more than 90% of American people to agree on anything.
Right.
And so this is an extraordinary number. And the other thing that's fascinating about it is it does cut across equally really demographic and political lines in all sorts of ways. I mean, the difference is 89% of men say it's very important, 85% of women. That's not much of a difference. It is worth pointing out that men and women do look at the economy differently. Women are much more pessimistic about the economy than men. There are some women in my office who say actually they're just more realistic, but that's a matter of interpretation, I suppose.
I know you also track employment and have just looked at the December unemployment numbers. What are you seeing that's different than what we're seeing in the mainstream about the employment?
Well, you know, I think if you take a look at all of the data that we have and everybody else, the picture is largely the same. That the public perception is less bad than it was 6 months ago, but it's a long way from being good. The last 3 months of our employment index have been the most positive assessment of the job situation since September of 2008. But at the same time, we have more people who tell us their firms are laying people off than hiring. And what we have seen on all economic matters is that people are very skeptical about recovery. They would like to believe it. They're trying to be hopeful, but very, very cautious. People who are still more likely to think their own finances are getting worse rather than better. And it's going to take a while before people have a change of heart about the economic situation.
Well, number two listed in terms of most important is health care. And I know the passage of the health care bill and the pressure for repeal is something you've watched a lot, particularly because it's been a real big
Tea Party issue, what do you think the real chances are of a repeal? And maybe talk a little bit about what the support is for a repeal and whether that's enough to get it done.
Well, the polling on the healthcare issue has been virtually unchanged for a year and a half. If you went to back to before the bill became law, Democrats loved it. Republicans and unaffiliated voters didn't. Now Democrats want to avoid repeal. Republicans and unaffiliated voters want to repeal. And our latest numbers show that 6 out of 10 voters favor repeal. But it's not quite that clear cut. There are many popular provisions in the law that was passed. I was stunned in 2009 that the Democrats didn't just, when I saw how difficult it was and how unpopular the law was, I was surprised they didn't just drop back and pass a few popular provisions, declare victory, and then focus on the economy. If there is ever a repeal, the Republicans will have to go in and pass some kind of reforms to address some of the concerns that are out there. In terms of where we stand right now, it's clear the House of Representatives is going to pass some repeal legislation. The Senate, highly unlikely to go along, but there could be some interesting maneuvering in the Senate because you've got 23 Democrats running for re-election in 2012. Many of them are from Republican-leaning states. They don't want to see the bill repealed, but on the other hand, they don't want to be seen defending the status quo either. My best guess is this is an ongoing campaign issue and through the 2012 elections. If Barack Obama is reelected, it's very difficult to see how the law becomes repealed, but significant portions of it may be cut back.
So you think this could be a presidential campaign issue?
Oh, I think it's going to be one of the top campaign issues. Clearly, as we've just talked, the economy is still number one. If the economy is doing much better in 2012, Barack Obama's prospects are much brighter. But this health care law will be a big issue. And another issue that's going to be right up there again, partly because it relates to the economy, will be taxes. You know, the president and congressional Republicans agreed on this temporary tax extension, and it expires right in the middle of the 2012 campaign.
Well, here's my question for the 2011 Congress. How is the Congress and this administration going to deal with the deficit, or are they just going to kick the can? And can they just kick the can?
Well, most voters expect them to. Only 12% expect that the deficit will be reduced by this Congress and president. Only 17% think there will be any significant spending cuts. So there's not a lot of hope and not a lot of expectation. And I think one of the problems that is facing this Congress is that politicians from both parties have been ignoring the driving forces of spending for the last few decades. Voters consistently vote for politicians who promise to cut spending. The last time that spending actually went down in America, Dwight Eisenhower was in his first term as president. And the reason, I mean, it's a long time back. And we have a couple of issues that nobody wants to talk about. Social Security, Medicare, and national defense make up a majority of the federal budget. If you throw in interest on the federal debt, you get up to 67%. So you're not going to cut spending if you don't talk about those areas. And when you talk about them, most politicians are very short-sighted in their discussion. They want to make drastic changes right away. But really, it's the long-term trends that matter. One of the things that we've talked about a lot and pulled on a lot is giving people the opportunity to choose their own retirement age. If you're young and you want to pay less in Social Security taxes, you could agree to defer your retirement at the other end. And there are ways that these things can be addressed with popular support, but it's going to take some creativity that so far we don't see in the current Congress.
Do you find more people hiring you to try and help them craft options than sort of reading the polls?
We don't make ourselves available for hire like that. So
okay.
Because we're a media company, lots of polling firms do make a lot of money like that. It is a real skill, and the biggest challenge that you have in that type of a world is getting clients who will really work with the data rather than their own belief. There's a famous story
right.
from the 1980s when Pat Caddell was hired by General Motors to give them a view of the state of the world. He was paid a very high fee to have lunch once a quarter with the CEO of General Motors, and when Pat told the CEO that people didn't like General Motors cars very much, they felt better about Japanese cars, GM fired the pollster rather than accepting the data.
Well, let's turn to your wonderful book, In Search of Self-Governance. Why don't you just briefly introduce the book to us and tell us how you came to write it?
Well, the book really came very quickly to me in terms of the main themes. It's things I've seen and talked about for a long time. I get frustrated in a world where everybody wants me to talk about what things are different. Why do Republicans disagree with Democrats? I like to focus on what unites us. And part of it is, unfortunately right now, a belief that our political system is broken and most politicians are corrupt. These are views that are held by most people. But we also believe in the founding ideals of this nation, including the fact that Americans don't want to be governed from the left or the right or the center. They'd like to govern themselves. And that's what we've done throughout history. And it seems we've lost our way a little bit on that, or at least we have a political elite today who would like to rule over us rather than see government in a support role. And it was because that view wasn't being articulated very much that I felt it important to put it on paper.
What one of the reasons I loved your book so much is what I have found. I live in Tennessee, but I travel a lot, mostly by car. And what I have found is that there is enormous consensus and there is enormous characteristics and belief in local and civic action
mm-hmm.
that really does reflect a tremendous consensus across the country. And yet that nobody ever gives it voice. And your book was really the first time I'd seen anybody who's prominent in the, in the political arena give that voice. It was really, I'm interested to hear what the response was when it first came out.
Well, it has been fascinating. People in the traditional political world are uncomfortable with it. They would prefer to talk more like Republicans are good and Democrats are bad, or they're vice versa. But they all think their view should be the ruling decision. And the Washington Post actually came out with a piece challenging the premise, and they said from their view, the American people don't want to govern themselves. They prefer to have others make the tough decisions, which floored me. But I'm like you. When I travel around and talk to people, these are the sorts of expressions you hear. When somebody has something they have to address in their personal life or in their finances, they don't instinctively run to the government. They talk to their friends and neighbors. They talk. They network. They do what they can. People come together and help in lots of ways that you couldn't possibly get in any other environment.
It's. I know I've read and I don't understand much about it, but you're part of a group. It's the Ocean Grove Camp Meeting, is that correct?
Camp Meeting Association, yes. And that's a group that began in 1869, and it was a group of Methodist preachers who set up a little camp meeting on the Jersey Shore, and it grew to become one of the most influential camp meetings of all time. Had great preachers like Billy Sunday and Amanda Berry Smith, and Billy Graham came to speak here. And it's an amazing thing. We own a little town on the Jersey Shore, and it is a place where you do see community service in action all the time, whether it's a volunteer fire department or something as simple as I can remember being a young boy and somebody bought a new refrigerator and we spent the whole day moving refrigerators to somebody else's house because they were all just passing them on to the neighbors.
One of the things I see a lot is it's incredible how much the churches and temples and other spiritual organization, the way I see it is you drive into town and there's a bank, there's a courthouse, and there's a church. and that's kind of how it works. And when you look at how much the churches are caring through volunteer effort to make things work, it's absolutely astonishing. And yet that that voice, you know, you never see that perspective. It's not part of the divide and conquer presentation. And yet, it's quite significant. So I was very interested to see what you were doing there.
Yeah, it's a very much a part of ordinary life for people. Many people pray on a regular basis or attend services. There are different levels of belief and different belief systems, but to suggest that it's not a vital part of American society is just silly. In fact, every year at New Year's, we put out a poll and we ask people, you know, what they're doing on New Year's Eve at some point during that day, and 66% of Americans said they'll say a prayer for the new year, and only 42% went out drinking. So more people prayed than drank on New Year's Eve.
Does that reflect the economy?
No, actually, it's been fairly stable over the years.
Okay. So tell me.
And by the way, I should, in full disclaimer, say, you know, younger people are more likely to drink than pray. It's older people who are more likely to pray.
One of the things you talk about is what I call the sort of the disconnect between Americans and what Americans say they want and the policy machinery in New York and D.C. And maybe you could touch on sort of some of what you call the threats to self-governance.
Well, you just really hit the key distinction. There are a group, there's a policy clique that revolves around Wall Street and Washington, and they have a fundamentally different view of the way our system is supposed to work. And we've done a lot of polling since I wrote the book exploring this topic, and just to give you a sense of it, while 85% of mainstream Americans think the country's gotten off on the wrong track, 67% of those in the political class think we're heading in the right direction. Their perspective, their view of things is the government really is supposed to be in charge and solve, you know, whatever problem comes their way. And they're a little bit disdainful and contemptuous of people who don't see it that way. And what has happened is over time we have developed a political system that actually repels people who have a different view. If you're not going along with the club, you really can't succeed in Washington. And we see it in all kinds of ways. We see it in the bailouts that were passed a couple of years ago. We see it in legislation that is proposed almost every day in Washington.
I never forget when I was working in the Bush administration, we were pitching some guys who'd run a commission and on new legislation that we wanted to pass, and there was a young special assistant there. And the guys who run the commission said, "Well, I thought you were Republicans and you believe in decentralization, which you're proposing is centralization."
Yeah.
And the guy looked at him and said, "Yeah, but we're here now."
Right, right. Yeah, and there is, you know, a lot of folks, you know, a lot of Republicans, a lot of conservatives who are in that political class world, they believe there should be different policy prescriptions, but the notion...
Control.
That's right. The notion that the American people will be quite capable of working on those things themselves just doesn't pass the smell test. But, you know, when we talk about this, I think it's really important that governance is not just about politics and government. We help govern the way business is run by the way we act as a consumer. If you go to a restaurant and they give you lousy service and you don't go back, that's a way of sending a message. Now, you may not feel good. You may not have jumped up and down and screamed at the chef. But by your action of not going back, you are having an impact on that organization. And we do the same thing with our friends, with our charitable efforts, the things that we give our time to or choose not to give our time to. And these are really the decisions that make America great. It's the decisions about faith and family, the decisions about what you're going to do with your career and how you're going to address the issues you're facing. The political system is one part of governing society, and it should be a supporting role, not a leading role.
Right. I think one of the things in your section about what can we do, one of the things I like so much is you really remind us of how powerful we are. It is all of our actions day to day that can make an enormous difference.
Right. So. And, yeah, you know, it's something I gave some examples from the civil rights movement in there and how attitudes changed because before the politicians did. I also talk about how we're already changing Social Security by planning not to rely on it when we retire. And there's all sorts of examples throughout American history when the changes that really mattered took place totally outside the political system. Do you happen to know when women first voted in the United States?
No.
It was back in 1869, and the first place that let women vote was Wyoming, not normally thought of as a very progressive state. But the reason that they let women vote was because it was a pretty rough territory then, and they couldn't get enough women to move out there. So the guys put together a package to help attract women as part of the Tourism Bureau, and that launched, you know, this the voting for women in America. And if you followed it through for the next 40 or 50 years, what you saw was whenever one side in a battle thought that letting women could vote would help, they gave women the right to vote, whether it was at a school board election or somewhere else. By the time Congress got around to acting on that, you know, it was a half a century later, more than 40% of Congress was already elected with the votes of women because states can make those decisions on their own. And in fact, there was a woman, Jeanette Rankin, who was already serving in Congress, and she introduced the resolution, and I think basically dared the guys to vote against it. And the other thing that happened was several other states were about to have women voting in the next election, and it clearly became an issue that was forced on Congress rather than something Congress did because of traditional political action.
Well, it's just it's a reminder, Latvia just dramatically reduced the residency requirements for people who want to move there. the economic competition
right.
for entrepreneurs has begun. Okay, Tea Party, very quickly, Scott, because I know
sure.
we're almost out of time. Tea Parties, tell us about the Tea Parties and what kind of impact they had on this election and what kind of impact you expect them having going forward.
Well, they had a huge impact on the last election. When we poll about the words that influence your choices, the Tea Party aroused more passion than any other political label in 2010. And since it didn't exist before that year, that's remarkable. The Tea Party, the reason it had such power, it was an authentic grassroots movement. It capped this fury that people had been voting for spending cuts that never happened. And finally, when the bailouts took place in the fall of 2008, a lot of people just were pushed over the edge. Then you had Rick Santelli's rant in February that gave voice to it. And it wasn't that those events created the Tea Party. They just tapped into a frustration that was already there and really ignited it, kind of like a brush fire waiting for a match. And when that happened, the official establishment politicians didn't know how to deal with it. Looking back, it became clear that Arlen Specter was really the first victim of the Tea Party. He was forced out of the Republican Party within a few weeks of the first Tea Party rallies. And we didn't attribute it to the Tea Party then, but it was the same anger that we saw play out throughout 2010.
And do you think the Tea Parties are active locally? I know in Tennessee they, you know, what I've seen is they are, but I don't have a feel for the country.
You know, there's, by depending on your count, 3,000 or 4,000 or 6,000 Tea Party organizations. Like any group that has sprung up rapidly, some of them are very active, some of them are not so active. But it seems that in most states there are some active chapters and that are providing forums and things. And I believe that they will be very influential in 2012. I don't believe it's possible to get the Republican nomination for president if you're not on good terms with the Tea Party. Where it goes beyond that depends on how the politicians respond. But I think it's important to note that if the Tea Party itself fades away as an organization or as a collection of grassroots organizations, the attitudes, the ideas that started the Tea Party will continue because they are shared by most Americans.
Yeah, the Tea Party is funny. The Tea Parties in actuality are so different than they seem to me being portrayed through the media. So, but
yes.
They're very much at the heart. You know, they're at the heart of Main Street.
You know, there was a man told me a story of his wife wanted to go to Washington. He thought she wanted to go to museums. She wanted to go to a Tea Party rally. And he said she's never been involved in politics before. And there have been a lot of those stories. And so they aren't following
uh-huh.
the usual script. There are politicians and organizations and financiers who are trying to put themselves in the front of the parade, and
right.
some of them are clearly providing some support, but that's not where the movement began, and they are more dependent on the movement rather than the other way around.
Well, tell us, going forward, how do we watch your work? How do we access your services? If somebody wants to stay, you know, listening to you, taking the pulse of America, how do we do that?
Well, the simplest way is to go to our website, RasmussenReports.com, and you can sign up for a newsletter there that we'll send out every day highlighting some of our activity. We also have a Twitter feed, twitter.com/RasmussenPoll. And on top of that, as you well know, we have a platinum service where you can go and get some more detailed information if you'd like.
And I recommend In Search of Self-Governance, Mad as Hell, and are on Amazon, available on all the online stores. And I just really I want to thank you for In Search of Self-Governance, and I really want to make a pitch that it's one of my most recommended books for what Americans can do. So, Scott, thank you so much for joining us on the Valeri Report. We appreciate it tremendously. Have a great day, and please keep up the good work.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for the kind words about the book.
Have a great day, Scott. Thanks.
Bye-bye now.
Okay. It's, again, a plug for that book. It's a wonderful reminder of how much power we really do have and the way that we conduct ourselves in our day-to-day lives. And it's a quick book. It's an easy read, and it's kind of inspiring. For our Let's Go to the Movies this week, I want to talk about something that's one of the challenges for communities and the civic action in communities, and that's the story. The documentary is called Gasland. It's Josh Fox's documentary made last year, and it premiered on HBO about hydraulic fracturing. There was a change to the Safe Drinking Water Act in the Energy Policy Act of 2005. Dick Cheney is credited with sort of slipping it in that that hydraulic fracturing no longer got a special exemption from the Safe Drinking Water Act. And that was part of several factors that have led to a significant increase in domestic drilling in the United States and North America for natural gas. Part of it, and this goes to show how much rules changes can affect the economy, part of it is also the changes that the SEC has apparently made to how reserves are counted for purposes of SEC disclosure and financial disclosure. So we're talking about things that can have a dramatic impact on the value of an energy company's stock as well. What Gasland does, Josh Fox is a very charming and talented, gifted young guy. His family has had a house in Pennsylvania, and one of the things that the fracturing, known as fracking, has done is it's because of the deposits along the sort of Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, West Virginia states. We're seeing great increases in drilling activity in areas that are not normally, they're not like the western states, they're not used to seeing, you know, oil wells go up or gas wells go up right next to their property. So we're talking about sort of the invasion of the drilling rigs in places not used to it. Josh is sitting in his home in Pennsylvania and gets an offer to lease the, I assume it's the mineral rights and the family land in Pennsylvania, and says, what is this about? And starts to investigate. And the next thing you know, he's interviewing various people who've had real serious problems with nearby drilling impacting their water supply. And so he starts driving around America talking to people, and what you're watching is the competition, not just for resources in a place, but real competition between different resources, because you've got one set of consumers who want energy and one set of investors who want their gas stocks to go up, and one set of corporate chieftains who want to make money on all of this moving to develop more gas. At the same time, we have real competition for water. It doesn't just, and Gasland don't get into the effort by corporations to buy up the water, but you but you see the, as he goes through the statistics, the competition between the desire for gas for a variety of reasons and the desire for water. And of course the subtext in all of this is population. How many people can a place, how many people can the planet handle and handle well? Now in Gasland you get and again I think Josh is a very charming guy, you sort of get the feeling that the corporations are the bad guys and government, whether it's state or local government, can't stop them. I don't think you see the full spectrum whole. You don't see the pressure from consumers. You don't see the pressures on corporations from investors or a variety of constituencies to produce the most profits at the least cost. So you don't get a sense of the whole ecosystem. But what you do see is the frightening extent to which someone can be literally have their neighbor do a deal for a drilling rig coming in next door and have their property destroyed because their water's destroyed and therefore the value of their property and the quality of their life and their health is really affected. So, and this is certainly something that you all have heard about me going through this year as I spent years building my self-sufficient home in Hickory Valley only to suddenly up and leave because my cousin does a deal for a cell tower next door. So this is something as the search for resources grows more and more intense is going to come up for many of us. And it's an issue that we're going to see again, whether it's natural gas or water or any of the others. But Gasland is something I recommend. It's a bit of a chilling story, but it's worth looking at to understand some of the pressures that are on us. So if you're interested, Gasland, Josh Fox, it's a good one. Anyway, that's it for this week. Again, we're going to have a transcript for the wrap-up for you by the next Solari Report, which will be in the first week of February. We're going to have Chris Martinson, the publisher of Crash Course, wonderful introduction and overview of the economy, available on video at Chris's site. And then the following week, Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders. I'll try and see if I can get Franklin to give us a prediction on the price of silver. Until then, Paul Ferguson and I would love to help you at Solari Silver and Gold. Let us hear from you. We think you need to diversify your assets with precious metals. If a correction is coming, that could be a good time. Let's see what happens. So until next, until the first Thursday in February, I wish you well. Don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, you need to start one. And until then, ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.